All right. Last time we took a look at the process by which the Gemara becomes accepted as a totality, and over time it becomes the established constitution of rabbinic Judaism. It wasn't an easy process. There was a competing Gemara, the Yerushalmi, and the Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, which was known as Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. It waged a pretty good fight to try to get the Yerushalmi to be the accepted Gemara, but for all kinds of reasons, some of which we may or may not go into, by fairly early on, the Bavli became the bottom line. As a result of the fact that we come to the end of the era of the Tanaim and Amoraim, as I mentioned, from now on, learning Gemara is no longer entering into a direct eye-level dialogue with or controversies with Tanaim and Amoraim. From now on, a person who wants to learn Torah and who wants to pask in halacha, the two go together, but they're not necessarily the same. You can certainly learn Torah lishma without halachic ramifications. We'll now approach the Gemara and understand it from the outside. In other words, I want to interpret it. I want to understand what it means. I want to elucidate it. I want to try to read between the lines to see what the underlying logic is, and so on and so forth. Now, that's not an easy task. It's not an easy task for a number of reasons. Number one, the Gemara is written in a way. We're going to talk about more of this next week. The Gemara is written in a very telegraphic fashion. There's a lot of material information that's not there if you just look at the text alone. If I were to pull the text of the Gemara away from Rashi, Tosfos, and all the guys on the side, it wouldn't be that easy to make a headway because it has no punctuation. As of right now, most people don't speak Aramaic, although I have to tell you there is a movement to revive spoken Aramaic, but not Jewish Aramaic. There are many different dialects of Aramaic. One of them is Syriac, which is Christian Aramaic from Syria. There's a form of Aramaic which is still the liturgical language of Christians in the northern part of the country. It didn't take very long for Aramaic to begin to decline. The reason for that was that even though Aramaic was the spoken language of the Jews in the Persian Empire at the period that the Gemara took place, they weren't speaking in Lashon Kodesh. They were speaking the language that they spoke. It's sort of like, I think I mentioned this last time, if you've seen Shakespeare in Love, speaking to each other in Shakespearean English, which is a little bit jarring initially, but that's Shakespeare wrote in the language that was spoken in his time, in Elizabeth. In any event, the same thing is true over here. People are speaking Aramaic. However, in the 630s and 640s, the Persian Empire falls to the Arabs, and slowly but surely, Arabic replaces Aramaic as a spoken language. It takes time, or as the language of discourse. It takes time for one to take over the other, but increasingly, the language itself, as we'll see, is difficult to understand. In addition, specific sugyas miss information. We're going to see an example in a minute. Let's look at the background stuff that we don't have, that the Gemara assumes you know. And as a result, the commentary is required if we're going to be able to understand it, understand Pashut Pshat, as we would say, never mind doing lumdus and iyun and analysis and so on and so forth. That's point number one. Point number two, is the fact that, after the, Talmud was, let's call it redacted, accepted, ratified, whatever the case might be, the spiritual leadership of the Jewish people was taken over primarily, again, in Eretz Yisrael they had a different view of these things, but still, it was primarily taken over by the central institutions in Babylonia, which were the heirs of the Tanaim and Amoraim, specifically two yeshivot, the yeshiva of Sura and the yeshiva of Pumbedita. Sura and Pumbedita, as you know, Sura is associated with Rav, and Pumbedita is associated with Shmuel, but by this time, certainly by the middle of the 8th century, by 100 years after the Arab conquest, the yeshivot have moved to the new capital city of Baghdad in the mid-8th century. In any event, the people who stand at the head of these two yeshivas are called Gaonim. Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva who's the pride of Jacob, and they are the address for everything. People go there twice a year during on Elul and Adar to learn Torah. During the rest of the year, the Gaonim and have an entire hierarchy of people and students and so on. They are the address for all religious concerns within the Persian Empire and then among the Arab in the Muslim in the Arab or Muslim world. at their side, over them, to the side of them. This is also a matter of dispute between the various agencies, is the Rosh HaGolah, the exilarch, who is the minister plenipotentiary for Jewish affairs at the court of the caliph, who sits in Baghdad from 749-750 on. So that they see themselves as the heirs directly of the Tanaim and Amorayim. It's as a result of, and don't forget one other last point, and then we'll go further. And don't forget that at this stage of the ballgame, roughly 95% of the Jews in the world live under Muslim rule. The amount of Jews in Italy, never mind in Germany, is negligible at best. So that you have a situation in which the rule, the authority of the Gaonim and of the Rosh Golah is enormous. They're basically in charge of all Jewish affairs from northern, from southern, from central and southern Spain all the way to Afghanistan and northern India. Okay, and everything in between. And the rule by which they live is, or the rule by which everybody's supposed to live is more or less based upon the Bavli. Okay. That's Talmud Torah. What's striking, therefore, is that they don't write a parish on the Gemara. It's stunning. Gaonim do not write perushim on the Gemara and distribute them. They're assuming people are going to learn, but they don't write perushim. Okay? Why not? But that's not fair. That's like giving somebody a gift with a lock and not giving them the key. So why not? So the truth of the matter is, there are two really separate lines of information, of explanation. And I have examples of each of them on the sheets. Take a look at number one is Perusha Gaon. And the first text is written by Harav Sar Shalom Gaon. That's a great name. Sar Shalom. He was the Gaon of, Surah, I believe, between 843 and 853. This is found in a volume called Chuvot Gaonim Kadmonim of, paragraph 46. Sar Shalom Gaon, okay? Sar Shalom Gaon is a question over here. Is Goyshik Nisyado B'toch Yenot Shel Yisrael? What do you do if a non-Jew touches Jewish wine? We know in general that if a non-Jew touches Jewish wine, he answers it. All right, and he says Kulam Mesubachot Zo Bezo Umafilot Bioter. Okay, the truth of the matter is, this is a very complicated question. The Im Hayaratzon. If you really wanted to, or if we had an eight ratzon, if things were appropriate or things were propitious, Vayitim Lefanenu, and you were us or before us, Haya Efshar Lefarshan Yafe Yafe, I'd be able to sit down properly and explain things to you, really down to the last detail. Ulevararan Yafe Yafe, and to clarify things point by point. Mizo kamut davar dibur alofanav, everything in its proper place. Mipnei kishetalmid yoshev bifnei rabo, when a student sits before his master, his teacher, v'yisa v'yitein bidvar halacha, and they're debating or discussing halachic matters, yodea rabo le'ezet sadli bo notei, knows exactly, the teacher can tell where the student's at. He can know it. Does he understand? Does he not understand? And what he doesn't understand, what he's yet to grasp, what's outside of his reach at the moment. Umamit barerlo, and what is occurring to him. Umamit akeshalav, and what is he either, what is he stuck on? Uposhetlo ad shemi'ir yadav. And he explains it, he makes it pashut, he makes it clear, he said it all out perfectly until his eyes shine. Umarelo panim bahalacha, and he shows him exactly what the proper halachic, what the proper interpretation is, the proper ruling is. Aval biktav kama efshalo ela miktzat sivinu v'katvulachem. He says, but if I write you a letter, the possibility there is that you won't understand. How much detail can I go into? How much can I possibly explain? I can't cover all the angles. There is no comparison. But you can't compare any way, shape, or form the live interaction between a student and a teacher and something which is written. Writing something leaves the possibility of lack of supervision and error. And in the case, and here, error will lead to what? If you have a shiloh. You want to, you'll do an Aveira, you'll do an Isser, you won't pocket properly. By definition, live interaction is superior to written interaction. In a word, the reason why, by implication, and we find this in other sources as well, by implication, what Rav Shalom Gaon is saying that I don't write long perushim, or we shouldn't write long perushim because of quality control. I want to make sure that you know. If you want to really learn, come to yeshiva and sit and learn. Don't sit and try to do this on your own. The Rambam controversial passages in the Mor Nevuchim, in the third part of the Mor Nevuchim, chapter 51, dealing with other issues, dealing with theological, philosophical issues, but it makes a very profound point. He says, you know, a guy, he describes the search for God as people being in a state or a city state, and they're all walking towards the castle and the palace is God, and so on and so forth. He says, some guys are walking towards the palace. Some people are walking out of the country. Why? This is a person who intellectually is trying to find God, but he made one mistake. Hey, one detour, forget it. You're sunk. You make your wrong left turn, you'll end up in Yehupitz. You're not going to end up in the palace. And that's basically what Rav Shalom is going to say. If you want to learn, come to me. We'll be able to teach you properly. What can I do? I'll give you a little bit in writing because I have to respond, but more than that I can't give you. By definition, self-learning is not a good idea. Now, understand something. That's a philosophy. That's a philosophy of not just of quality control, but also of all the truth is here, and you have to accept our opinions. Okay? There's an idea of centralization involved, which is endemic, or inherent, more importantly, to the Gaonim. They had it all, and everything begins with us and ends with us, and there's no other center. Yes?
So, with the Gemara having already been written down by this stage, is not a little bit too late to say, to have this sort of quality control?
Yes and no, because still you can't get the keys to it until you master the Masechta and the Yeshiva. But you're right. Even releasing the book is, but then the question is to what degree the Gemara is circulated. But there was circulation. Okay, in terms of that, take a look at the next text, which is a letter which was written by Rav Shrira Gaon, who actually was quite a long time. He died in 1006, but he apparently was born around 906. He is for what's called Igeret Rishvira Gaon, which is one of the major sources for rabbinic histories. He was asked what is the history of rabbinic tradition, and how does it start, and how can you authenticate it, and so on and so forth. Rishvira Gaon, but he also wrote a bunch of other letters which have been preserved. He's responding here to a situation which we'll come back to, in which from the 8th, 9th, up until the middle of the 10th century, the Gaonim really were the address for everything Jewish in the world. People wrote letters to the Gaonim from all over the world, even from the Christian world, even though there was a great, you know, to be anachronistic about it, iron curtain that divided Islam from Christendom. Still, we know that there were contacts between Bavel and Ashkenaz, never mind, within Eretz Yisrael. We know that we have thousands, literally thousands, of responsa that were written by the Gaonim. They didn't write Perushim to the Gemara, but they wrote responsa. If you had a Shaila, you sent it to Bavel. I mean, sometimes you had to function on your own. If you shechted a cow and you didn't know if it was kosher or not, till you get the letter back from Bavel, forget the cow's gone. It's rotten, whatever. You have local authorities that have to do something. But in the big things, you wrote to Bavel. We have literally thousands of tshuvas that have survived from this correspondence from all over the Muslim, the Muslim world. In any event, in the middle of the 10th century, there was a break. There was civil wars and rebellions that broke out in the Mediterranean, and contact between Western Jewish communities and Bavel was broken. And then it was restored. And in this letter of Shrira Gaon, who lives towards the end of the period of the Gaonim, the period of the Gaonim ends in 1038, with the death of, officially, with the end, they, Gaonim kept functioning, but for the point of view of creativity, the last Greek Gaon was Rav Hai Gaon, he died in 1038. They're trying to restore the relations with the rest of the Jewish communities of the world. And he writes to the West, he writes as follows. So he pleads with them, come, send us your questions, send us your information, and so on. Okay? What had happened was, if you say to yourselves, Ki tisharun atem al matkuntchem. Okay? that you're going to stay, keep things the way they are. In other words, in the absence of what happened was, in the absence of contact with Bavel, Jews started interpreting the Gemara on their own. They started basketing on their own because they had no choice. They had no. There was no. What else are they going to do? Okay, nishchetet. He says, if you don't support us and you let us go down. Hello, Rashechem Hema. Okay? We are, or the heads of the yeshiva are your heads, they're your leaders. Kvod Rashechem, Shiftechem, the heads of your house, of your leaders and your tribes. The Echi Shachet Harosh, Vishalem Haguf, Acharos Haguf Olech. You're the body, we're the head. If you allow the head not to function, if you don't support the head, if you don't send us your donations as well as your questions, then the whole body politic will go down. Hakitzu na'achenu, wake up! Vabitu be'eva v'simu kavod l'shem elokechem l'tarato l'chachameha. And give honor to God and to the Lord your God and to His Torah and to the sages of the law. Uluchub minhagavodechem, do what your fathers did. Ubederech horechem, and what your parents did. Vachziru at the davar liyoshno, return the situation to what it was earlier. Vagidu lanu sveikotechem, tell us your doubts, tell us your questions. Leman tirunet hatshuvot, so you can receive the answers that we're going to give you, just as we did for the past hundreds of years. And learn them. Vagam yechazek lev chachmei harishivot, and this way you'll also sustain and strengthen the heart of the sages of the wise men of the yeshiva. Bir otam ki atem ponim aleihem. They're depressed. Nobody's asking them any questions. A teacher without students is a very sad thing. Upochadim lemazoneihem. They don't know where their next meal is going to come from because you're not supporting the yeshiva. V'yodim makom tircham b'torah, and they know. Okay, or you know. Mekom torcham b'Torah minatshuvot. You know how involved they are in Talmud Torah from the answers you've gotten previously. Ude'u, and you should know something. Ki lo lechvodenu, we're not doing this because for our kavod or our money. V'lo lechvod beit avinu dibarnu aleichem kashot kaila. We're not chastising you because we're worried about our kavod or our yichus or kavod of our ancestors. Ki lechvod Hashem, we're doing this for the honor of God. V'lechvod Torato, and for the honor of his Torah, leman lo yovdun arba amoteha, because the dalet amos of Torah are here in this yeshiva, or in these two yeshivas, Sura and Pupedita. Ki afilu rav ta Torah, even if the Torah increases elsewhere, harbei ma'od b'mekomot achirim, in other places, v'ulam arba amot shel halacha hinei heim, heinahem. The real dalet amos of halacha are here in Baghdad. V'zot Tatsura, and this institution. In other words, these two yeshivas. Hu b'mkom Sanhedrin. They are the heirs of the Sanhedrin, the fount of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Rambam, for example, who was not a big fan of the Gaonim later, writes that he says that the Amud, the Rambam in the beginning of Me'ilah. Maybe we have one here. Is this here? Torah. That's my luck. It's never. Okay, if you can find it, it's Hilchos Mamrim Perek Aleph. The Rambam says that Beis Din HaGadol is the Amud HaTorah Shebaal Peh. So basically, they're saying the same thing, that the Amud the fountain of all Torah Shebaal Peh is these yeshivas. Rosha ubimakom Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, that's a very, very, very powerful statement. But it gives you an idea of just how central the Gaonim saw their role. Okay? And, by the way, I would mention in passing, this is not something we're going to talk about in the Shiurim, but the truth of the matter is that as far as the Gaonim were concerned, I have it here. Okay. The Rambam Hilchos Mamrim Perek Aleph Halacha Aleph. Beit Din HaGadol Shev Yerushalayim Heim Ikar Torah Shebaal Peh. Veim Amudei HaHoraa Mehem Chok U'Mishpat Yotzei L'Chol Yisrael. V'aleihem Hivticha Torah Shenemar Al-Pi HaTorah Asher Yoruchah Azu B'Tzvat Asei V'Chol HaMamin B'Moshe Rabbeinu V'Torato Chayav L'Smoch Maaseh Adat Aleihem L'Shayin Aleihem. They are claiming that authority. If not 100%, 90%. Okay. Nobody else is able to compete. Similarly, the traditional Sephardic position was against machloket, that there's one truth, there's one halachic truth, and when we say elu ve'elu, divrei elokim chayim, that means that in the absence of a Sanhedrin, then you do the best you can. But ultimately, you try to get the absolute halachic truth. The truth of the matter, the fact of the matter is that that Ashkenazim believed in Balagan, but again, they believe that Machlokas was inherent. They think that they like it. They like what a Medrash in Medrash Tillim, where there's a Machlokas even in heaven. According to one Girsa, God is fighting with the Malachim over a certain din, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, I can't live like this. And God says, what do you want from my life? It looks like the Malachim are going to win. It's a very, very strange. Anyway, that's not the point. That's not our issue right now. The point is that this is a very centralized view of Torah. Okay? Ad kidei kach, take a look at the last text before we go on. If you look at the last text, is a letter again from Rav Shrira, where they ask, it's interesting when you have, with the rise of Islam and Christianity for the first time, you really have questions about apostasy. In the days of Chazal, in the time of when Jews would go and worship Avodah Zarah, that didn't mean that they were abandoning Judaism. And worshiping Avodah Zarah is a very, very serious sin. It's probably one of the most serious sins there are, one of the three most serious sins there are. But when you went to go worship Avodah Zarah, that did not involve having to make a statement of, I no longer will be Jewish. It's like what Jeremiah describes in his book, or what we know from historians, what happened in the time of the Hellenists, that in the morning you go to the base of Mikdash, in the afternoon you go to Jupiter or Zeus or whoever, and you play, and you go back and you sort of live your life in a sort of very eclectic, unprincipled manner. But no pagan demanded, except for maybe Antiochus and Adrian, and they were the exception, that you actually abandoned Judaism. Christianity and Islam actually made the claim that when you become one of the other, that you actually stop being Jewish. So that the Gaonim were the first who had to deal with the question of, is there such a thing as denaturalization, if you want, as far as being Jewish is concerned. So it's in that context you start getting questions like the one that's faced Rav Shmira Gaon, which this one is found in one of the collections of Gaonic, of the Gaonim called Shuas HaGaonim Shar Tzedek, Chele Gimel Shar Hei Simen Ches. Rav Shmira Zal, Vishishaltim, the question was like this, Yisrael Shinishtamed, a Jew converted to Islam, V'yeshlo isha Yisraelit, and he has a Jewish wife. He abandoned his wife, converted to Islam, his wife is Jewish. Whether she's still married with him is an interesting question. Don't know. V'nolad lo ben mimena b'shabbat. Oh, maybe he's tzedakah. It's a mixed marriage. Sorry. So she's still Jewish, and he became Muslim, and she gave birth on Shabbos. Mutal lemolo b'shabbat in love. There's all kinds of questions why this would be a question. B'chlal, notice the way, however, Rav Shrira opens the answer. Kach herunu min hashamayim. That's a very powerful statement. Now, how in practice they would determine the answers to questions is that the members of the yeshiva would, whoever was in town, would sit there and discuss it, and ultimately the Gaon would make would paskin. His was the ultimate authority. But the authority which Rav Shira Gaon here is invoking for his psak is kach heruna min hashamayim, assuming that there's Ruach HaKodesh that stands behind and endorses and guides the Gaonim. Okay, so just to see what his answer is, shemuta lemolo b'Shabbos. There's no reason not to do the bris on Shabbos. My time, or why not? Zaro shel Avram v'tolas Yaakov. He's a descendant of Avram and Yaakov. V'efshir shetoev v'ozev is banav b'dat Yehudis. In other words, and it's possible that he'll leave his children as Jews. Not only that, but the mother's Jewish, and he may follow her. We're not going to assume that the child is not going to be is going to follow Islam. Therefore, there's no reason to delay the bris. We can't change anything. So, with regard to slaves, the sages said, that in a situation where the mother, in this case the Shifchash Kananis, has, incurs, engenders, Tumas Yoledes, her child is, her son is Nima Lishmona, Bezer Yisrael Kol Shekein, of 100% Jew, certainly that's true, as well, Ad Hena. Notice, by the way, notice the way the thing is written. The written is very apodictically. He quotes one Gemara, most of it's Svara, most of it's just logic, boom. Again, this quality control. He's giving a dictate, that's the din, accept it. Alright, that's very much the way the Gaonim functioned. So their authority is, in this case, is found, it finds expression in an apodictic versus a blank kind of, tshuva on the one hand, and secondly, that they're not publishing, Perushim. Now that doesn't mean that they never ever wrote Perushim. Okay? There were two types of Perushim among that the Gaonim did write. If you wrote a specific question to the Gaonim, what does a specific sugya mean, you would get an answer. Usually that meant interpretation of strange words or something. But they never published anything to empower, as it were, independent study, on a broad scale. It's a type of monopoly which they developed and which they encouraged. What?
Did all the communities adhere to this, or some communities they said, no, we've got a marriage, should we dilute it going?
That's another question. That's a broader question which I can't go into. I mean, I don't want to go there. But, I mean, it's an important question, but it's not for now. In any event, if you want to get us, yes. Yes, that's the point. This is exactly the way that what you see from this tshuva is totally typical of the Gaonic period.
No, it's
in the time of Chazal.
Yeah.
In the time of Chazal, no, because it was an ongoing living type thing. If you want to go learn, you had it. Don't forget, in the time of Chazal, if you wanted to learn, you had to go study with somebody because it was Torah Sheb Ba'al Peh.
You had to go to decentralized.
Then what happened way over time? Initially, there's a big debate about how this works. There's a debate among scholars how this worked. Generally speaking, however, you wandered from teacher to teacher, and you stayed around with a guy for a certain amount of time. And you went to another one, and you collected masorot and discussions and so on. Over time, there seems to have been more centralization and more centralized batei medrash, but that's a matter of dispute. But long distance learning couldn't, by definition, exist. I mean, you had occasionally have correspondence between Eretz Yisrael and Babel and stuff like that, but it was not done. It was generally done orally, I should say. Okay.
Right, generally, would say at least today or in more recent times, the Judaism is somewhat the opposite. Like we're different to Christianity, we're different to other religions, where it's expected that the layman is somewhat.
Yeah, that's we're going to see that in 2 minutes when we shift from the period of the Gaonim to the period of the Rishonim. That's exactly the difference. Exactly the difference. The Gaonim claimed absolute authority. They said that they had, and they paskened all the shilas, and then that's nothing else to talk about. Okay? If you want to take a look at the kinds of, so earlier on, in the early period, before this break that I mentioned before in the middle of the 10th century, if you wrote a direct question, what does this mean? You'll get an answer. But you won't get Perushim written. After the break is restored, the three major figures among the last of the last three great Gaonim, Rav Shmuel ben Chofni and Rav Shrira and Rav Shrira's son Rav Hai, they begin to write monographs and Perushim and stuff like that. But that apparently is partly as a result of the fact that halacha was becoming decentralized and decentralized fast. So we're doing this as a way of getting, you know, restoring strengthening ties between the communities in the West and Babel. Just give an example of the kind of, sort of like focused comment that you would get. This happens to come from Rav Hai, but it's fairly typical. A Gemara you saw, I assume, right? You did the Gemara about, what happens if Nebuch, the father dies, the mother dies, and there's going to be a wedding and so on. Okay. So said the Gemara, V'davka aviv shalchasen o'ima shalkalo, deleka inish detarach lehu aval ipchalo. Nobody's going to take care of them, so therefore, but if it's the chasen's, what was it, the chasen's mother, or the kala's father, then you do the funeral first, and then you go and you go and have the wedding afterwards. The Gemara doesn't tell you. Rashi doesn't tell you. It's interesting. Rashi doesn't tell you. What are we worried about? What are they going to take care of? There's a missing piece of information here. That piece of information is what Rav Hai tells us. Va'ama Rav Hai, Dafka Aviv Shel Chatan V'Ima Shel Kala, Deleka Inish Detaraklu, Aval Ipchalo, the Derech Av Litrach Besudas Benok Shuchosim. The father goes and makes the party. He's the one that gets the caterer when the son. It used to be. I don't know what the state and what goes on in South Africa now, but I know when I was growing up in the States, the Kala's family paid for the wedding, and the Chassan's family played for the flops, or the flop, when I was a kid, the flop, the yes, come out later, the flowers, liquor, orchestra, photographer, and now Scheitel. In Israel, it's 50-50, and you go according to who, how many guests you have, because we don't have as much money. In any event, by the time of the Gemara, the assumption was that the Chassan made the party. So the father's gonna make the party for the Chassan one. Aval Imav, Eino Morech Mesudasa, but his mother is not, Eino Torech, sorry, in the party. Vaf Imo Shel Chosin, Eino Yechol Lamod Bekach, and the mother of Chosin also is not involved. Or he can't even deal with it. Vegam, Derech Imo Shel Kal Lamod Betachshiteha, and the mother of the bride is the one in charge of her, in this case we're talking, it appears to be not her jewelry, but her, what's it called? Cosmetics. Her makeup, whatever. Lefichach bizman haGemara shegamr shegamr suda lezev tamrukezol so meis avizel imashelzol. Then you have to put it off. Now it says, but therefore these are irreplaceable people in terms of the wedding per se. So she's already made up the color's already made up. She's already put on her Yemenite crown or whatever it is. And those are very fancy and very hard to do. Okay, so she's already ready to get married. Or the chassan's father, he's in charge of the meal. They die, so nobody's going to take care of it later. That's why the delay of the wedding is only, I'm sorry, the delay of the Shiva is restricted to these cases. So he gives you, boom, one piece of critical information to allow you to understand the flow of the sugya. That's it. Okay, it's very, very focused. Okay, now. All of this begins to change, as you could already tell, or begin to tell, at the time of the break, the time that communication between Bavel and the West, especially Spain and Germany and France, happens. Then you begin to get a situation in which the authority of the Gaonim becomes broken, or it becomes distanced, and the communities are on their own. And at precisely this time, from the early 11th century, from the time of Rav Hai Gaon's death anyways, you have the beginnings of writing Perushim for local consumption on the Gemara. They happen in three separate, simultaneously, it's striking, three separate locations. In the city of Cairo 1, in North Africa, which is the major economic and political center of North Africa in general, and of North African Jewry in particular. There lives a person whose name is Rabbeinu Hananel, whose family actually came from Italy, not from the Arab countries. And he sits down and he starts writing a perush, some of which is written, printed in the Vilna Shas, but most of which is not printed in the Vilna Shas for reasons we'll talk about next week, but which is you can function in the Gemara with Rabbeinu Hananel on your own. At almost the exact same time in the late 10th century, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Chanoch, okay, comes from Italy. According to one legend, he was on the same boat with Rabbeinu Hushiel, the father of Rabbeinu Hananel, and was sold into captivity or redeemed from captivity in Spain. He sets up a yeshiva under the aegis of Chasda ibn Shaprut, who was the wazir, the prime minister, as it were, of the, at the time already, the Caliph of Cordova, whose name was Abdurrahman III, and he sets up a tradition of independent study. And at precisely the same time, in Germany, comes a man whose name was Rabbeinu Gershon ben Yehuda Mor HaGola. He didn't call himself Mor HaGola, they called him that later. In Mainz, he originally was either from, he had Italian roots as well, apparently, or some people think so, from Ancona. And he starts a process which we're going to talk about in terms of independent study of the Gemara. So in other words, all three places, the same thing happens once the ties with Bavel cease or decline. With those three individuals, we have the period of the Rishonim, because now they're writing Perushim. where they go is what each one does, and the style of each one, and what the importance of each one is. That's what we're going to talk about for the next few sessions. Okay. What I want to do first, however, is give you a sense of the struggle that was involved in terms of putting the Gaonim in their proper perspective, as it were. Again, stuff that was written by Gaonim was taken very seriously, because most Jews did accept the idea that these were the heirs of Abaye and Rava. And okay, so it might be a little bit too extreme to say that they're Moshe Rabbeinu and the Sanhedrin, but still, this is serious, this is very serious. And you have different types of positions. Look at number two. This is a famous passage. We're not going to do all of it. This is a famous passage by the Rosh. Now, the Rosh, Rabbi Yechiel, lived at the turn of he lived in the second half of the 13th century, early part of the 14th century. But in this passage, he sums up attitudes towards Gaonim. Okay? Again, this is a very famous passage from the Rosh, and whenever you get to learning Sanhedrin, this is going to figure very prominently. So he writes like this: Katav Balamor. He says, he's quoting Reb Zrachi Halevi of Gerona, who lived in 12th century Catalonia and then in Provence. Shemat Zal. So this Balamor, he wrote a book called the Sefer Maor Agadola Katan on the Rif. He's an interesting story. He was the perpetual competitor of the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham ben David Poskir. They learned together in the same base medrash. In the end, the Ravid got to marry the Rosh Hashiva's daughter, the Rabbi Avraham Beit Din, the author of the Eshkol, and not him. And then they both lived across the street from each other in the same town of Poskir, and they were at each other's throats for their entire lives. This one wrote a Perish, this one wrote a Sagas, this one wrote a Sagas, this one a Perish. I mean, it was like constant. Until finally, he went back to Charona. In any event, the Baal HaMor writes as follows: Shamati mishum chacham gadol michachmei doreinu. I heard from a contemporary scholar, great contemporary scholar, shelefaneinu, from michachmei doreinu shelefaneinu, before us, da'idna, nowadays, let lantoa b'shukul adat. The Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses the question of when can you overturn a ruling of a court based on a mistake. So the Gemara makes a distinction between Dvar Mishnah and Shikul Adat. If you make a mistake based on reasoning in a ruling which is not 100% accepted, so you don't overturn the ruling. However, if you make a mistake and often a Mishnah, and often a Gemara, and often a Din that people accept, then we disqualify the whole trial and you start all over again. He says nowadays there is no room for consideration. We have everything's already al gepaskin. Everything's all paskin. Finished. We have all the final line lines. O min hashas. It's either explicit in the shas. O min hageonim shachar hashas. In other words, whatever is written said by the geonim has the same authority as whatever is written in is explicitly written in the Gemara. Hilkach. Therefore, there's no room for discretion. That's what I was looking for. There's no room for discretion because it's all written down. Whenever you make a mistake, if it doesn't line up with the Gaonim, with Shas, Mela, or the Gaonim, then you overturn the ruling. Vani einira. Okay, and so that's what the Baal HaMor said. That's what that individual said to him. It's all akapaskent. Meaning that there was a general feeling that the Gaonim were a blind authority. You have to defer to them. Whatever they said, that's it. Vani said the Baal HaMor, I don't like this. Ein nira li dvarim halalu. I don't agree with that. Elakomi she'ein ta'usa mizbareret min ha-mishnah min ha-shas meforsh b'li safek lav toed b'dvar mishnahu. I'm sorry, not true. Unless you make an absolute mistake on something you split in the Mishnah and the Gemara, it's not Toshu Shikol Das. In other words, what world do I live in? Am I living? Do the Gaonim? Do they get to participate in the authority that is given to the Gemara, Or are they just, we're living in the, we're all living in the world in which everything has to pass muster with the Talmud. So if I can come up with the Gemara and I can undermine or reinterpret or disagree with the Gaonim, I have that right. Which world am I living in? Okay? That's precisely the question over here. Notice what the Gaonim were claiming. We're the Ezra Rava of a Rava. So therefore we have a right to decide what all the Perushim are. We have a decide to write all Piskei Halacha and goodbye. And the Balamor says, no! We're in a different era. Finished. So therefore, if you make a knife, if a Shri Yargon makes it often a mistake, if I find sign, I'm not going to sit there and defer to him. The rest of this rush, we're not going to go through all of it, you're invited to go through, goes through various, he quotes the Ravid that disagrees, he's in favor of the Gaonim, although that's some problematic statement, and then the rush says it depends. Ah, the bottom line is that there's a shift away from the extreme authority given to the Gaonim, both in Parshanot and in Psak, toward reasoned discussion and convincing argument. This kind of position finds expression in the Rambam in a very the Rambam was totally against the sort of like a monopoly on authority and opinion that the Gaonim had. In the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, he writes, Udvarim halalu. He talks about all the stuff that happened after the Talmud was accepted, or the Talmud was redacted or sealed. Udvarim halalu bedinim gzeirot v'takanotu minagot shenitchatshu acharei chibur ha-gemara. All the stuff that happened after the Gemara was finished. Aval kol advarim shebegemara bavli chayavim kol Yisrael lechet bem. We saw this. All Jews have to accept the Gemara. All the Jews have to accept the Bavli. The kofin kolir v'yevachol medino medina lachol l'hod b'chol ha-minhagot shenagu chachmei ha-gemara ul'gzor gzeirotam l'lechet b'chukotam b'takarotam. Every Jew, everywhere, can you coerce it? That's the Constitution. That's the bottom line. Everybody has to pass muster with the Gemara. Ha'wil v'chol otam advarim shebegemara hiskim olem kol Yisrael. They were all ratified, like we said last week. V'otam ha-chachamim. Okay, skip. To the middle. V'chol ha-chachamim shamdu achar chibur ha-gemara. All of those sages who lived after the Gemara was finished, ubanu bo, and they built upon it, v'yatza lehem shem b'chochmatam, and they had a reputation for their wisdom, heima nekra'im ge'onim. All of the post-Talmudic stages are called ge'onim. Okay? Not just people in Babylonia. It's a generic. V'chol elu ha-ge'onim shamdu, where? Be'eretz Yisrael, u'be'eretz Shinar, that's Bavel, u'bisfarad, u'bitzorfat, lamdu darach ha-gemar, v'otzi'a lor tamulotav, u'be'eru inyanav, l'fisha darachot darach ha-abukahim mod. So he's basically saying, no! After the chatimat ha-gemara, just like the Baal HaMor says, it's an open ball game, because the shever is here, and it's open. And therefore, independent, therefore, interpretation is part of the ball game. Alright? And it's that shift in attitude which made Rishonim possible. You follow? It's almost, I don't want to call it democratization, but it's certainly not the kind of monopoly that the Gaonim were talking about. As an advance, okay, now where you find the most extensive commentaries, that's what we're going to talk about next time. Okay. What we're talking about next time is in Ashkenaz. In Germany and in France. We're going to talk about Svardik Rishonim, and we will get to that. But it's important to start with the Ashkenazim for reasons we'll see next week. It was there that the yeshivot that were started in Mainz and then in Worms, okay, were almost the opposite. Like the polar opposite of the yeshiva in Bavel. The yeshiva in Bavel, you had the Gaon, and you had this guy's rank, and that guy's rank, and everybody's rank. And in one place, there are a number of indications that if you were in the yeshiva with the Gaon, or with the Yerosh Kala, or this one, that one, you couldn't open your mouth until you were given permission. Because it was that formalized and stylized. And the Gaon had their own big guy, their own uniforms, and their own robes, and it was similar to the way, in fact, that the Caliph's court, ran in terms of its protocol, and so on. Caliph, okay? Take a look instead, by contrast, we'll finish with, as a sort of a tease for next time. A passage, a very precious passage from the Or Zarua. The Or Zarua was written in the mid-13th century, but it's an encyclopedia of things that reflect Ashkenazic Jewish life all the way back to the beginning to the 10th century. Okay? This is at the very beginning of Hilchos Rosh Hashanah. What do you do when you have a mila, you have a bris mila on Rosh Hashanah? Amar Abba Mari, my father, Rabbi Yehuda ben Klonimus, okay, said in the name, this is actually quoted by, this is a tradition that is brought down in the name of the Rebbe Elazar Rokeach, who was the author of the Rokeach, he was the head of, one of the last key leader of Hasidic Ashkenaz, and was one of the two Gedolei Ador in Germany at the time, the other one being the Ravya. B'shem Marana v'Rabana Rabbi Yehuda ben Chassid, who was in the name of his teacher, our master and teacher Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, in the name of his father Shmuel Chassid, Shama b'shem Reb Klonimus Hazaken ben Rabbi Yitzchak ben Rabbi Eliezer Agudel. We have a teacher to teacher to teacher, father to son, in one case, tradition among the elite of the Ashkenazi community. These are all members of the Klonimus family or their students, and they were like one of the two elite families in the Rhineland. Shei Rabim again said, once happened in Mainz, Mila Barosh Hashanah. They once had a baby guy gave birth on the week before Hashanah. So the baby had to be on Rosh Hashanah. Vishalu l'kedoshim asher ba'aretz. And they asked the sainted ones in the land, who are they? Rabbeinu Gershon ben Yehuda Mor Hagola and his students. Rabbeinu Shimon HaGadol ben Yitzchak, who was a famous Paitan as well. Rabbi Yehuda HaKohen Shal Sefer Adinim. Rabbi Yehuda HaGadol Shahaya Rosh HaLenah Ragim. Ushar b'nei Yeshiva HaKedoshah. Okay, they asked the big boys. They asked the Rosh Hashiva and all the senior Talmidim. Okay, v'horu kulam, and they unanimously said, lamul hanar lachar kriyat haTorah v'aftara kodem shiitku b'shofar. So you should do the bris after the haftara, but before tkiyas shofar. Why? Kedei shetehe bris mila tchufa l'tkiyas shofar, so that the real bris should be segue right into. The blowing shofar. Sheyizkor lanu akadosh baruch hu bris Avram vakedoso shel Yitzchak. So that God should remember us on Rosh Hashanah. We should recall first the covenant of Abraham, and after that, the binding of Isaac. Because of course, according to tradition, one of the shofarot that was on Har Sinai. Was from the ram that was sacrificed instead of Isaac, and the other shofar will be blown at Gibeah Samashiach. But the Akeshes Yitzchak is invoked. One of the reasons why we blow a ram's horn specifically is in order to remember Akeshes Yitzchak. That's the Gemara in first parak in Rosh Hashanah. They view smach l'divrayim, and they proved their point. Mimatbeah shetavu chachamim betfilas hayom, from the formulation that the rabbis adopted in our in the liturgy for Rosh Hashanah. V'kayim lanu Hashem Elokeinu v'sabris v'sachesed v'sashvur shenishbatel Avraham Avinu b'har Moriah v'teira'el lefanecha akedah shakad Avraham Avinu v'titzak b'no al gabei hamizbech. Dahainu, from this which you see, Dahainu, bris comes first, meaning bris mila, v'chakach hakeda dahainu tkiya shayfer, shenishcha tmuru ayel, that the ram was offered instead of Yitzchak. Furthermore, v'od chasimas habracha v'akedas Yitzchak lezaru ayel b'tizkor b'rachamim, we have b'rachamim tizkor, baruch ata Hashem zocher habrit, and the next one is v'samach layin, afterwards, Nigata Nigleta, which after we finish Zichrona, this is the end of Zichrona, then comes Shofros. Then a Shofros, Vichosman Shomea Kulturus Amo Yisrael Barachimim. So you see again first that Akedah Yisrael comes first and then Shofros. This is striking, methodologically, because they're deriving Halacha from the liturgy. But that's another story. There's no Gemara here, nothing. You're proving your Halachic point based on the way on the Nusach HaTfilah, which, okay, I'm just calling that to your attention. Now, so they paskind. What would you do if that were the case? What would you do? Rabbeinu Gershom and all of the Gedolei Olam, they all said, first bris mila, then Tkiyas Shofar. What do you do?
You do that!
No. Very good, you do. Listen, that's, they paskind. What are you going to say? No. V'harbe mibnei ha-yeshiva ha-kedosha ya kashele b'neihem lakev Tkiyas Shofar. Bunch of the students objected. We don't want it to like Kiyas Shofar. Kol kach b'shvil ha-mila. Why should he had a baby, so what? Why should we delay Kiyas Shofar for that? The ratzel in chosad gmar kol ha-tfilah. They wanted to put it up till after Musaf. Ve'yeshivam Rabbeinu Gershom, and Rabbeinu Gershom replied to them, imein mila ain't Kiyas Shofar ba'olam. What? Tell me, talk about it. The one from Bris Mila, there's not going to be Kiyas Shofar, there's no nothing. Why? Shenamar, im lo brisi, among the lila, who goes to Shemayim Varis, but lo something. The whole world depends on the bris. So you're not going to have anything else. So of course the priority has to go to Bris Mila. Oh, the mitzvahs beis Mila kadmelet kia shayfer. Bris Mila came before it was given to Avraham Avinu. It was before it came, whether it's kia shayfer anywhere. Okay, and even in the Torah, Bris Mila comes first, Tazria comes before Amor. Emor is where you perhaps keep Yom Kippur Zichron Shor Yelachem, and then the Tazria is a couple, two parshas before, whatever it is, and the three parshas before. Okay, so what are you doing? But look what's going on over here. This isn't Kach Harunah Min Hashemayim. This isn't the God saying this is the Kabel Dati. They paskin the Talmidim said no, Ma Pitom, we thought proper, blah, blah, blah. And he's got to go and defend. And Rabbeinu Gershom is defending his position to the discussion, to the objections of the Talmidim. That's striking. That's a whole different atmosphere. This is a very much open, free-playing kind of atmosphere where the Rebbe gives a perush and it goes back and forth and you have a collective discussion. Okay, which means you can also have room for what? More than one opinion. It's a whole other ballgame. So as a result, so this is the atmosphere in which Rabbeinu Gershom, so it's not just independence of Ashkenaz from Bavel. It's not just that Rabbeinu Gershom is going to come up with one shot and that's it. But it's not just a matter of fact, it's a matter of content, it's a matter of style. It's much more open, much more freewheeling, and it's against that background that we're going to examine next week what are called Perushei Magensa, which then morph into Perush Rashi when Rashi comes to Germany and then returns to France. So next week we'll talk about the initial Perushim of Rabbeinu Gershom, and then we'll talk about how that Rashi and what sets Rashi apart and why it was Rashi's Perush that ended up conquering the day. And in fact, the fact that Rashi's Perush was so good and spread like wildfire, relatively speaking, as fast as things could go in the Middle Ages, that the Perush of Rabbeinu Hananel really was preserved in manuscript, but was not really studied all that much over time, because you compare Rabbeinu Hananel to Rashi, we will do that. I'll show you parallel passages. There's not really much to, it's not compared. Rashi is clearly the superior work. Hold on.